Good afternoon. Welcome to the Energy Utilities Technology Committee of the 128th Maine Legislature. We have on our agenda today an update on Maine offshore wind development from the University of Maine, and then we'll have biomass presentations at around 2. I want to welcome everyone here, ask that you silence cell phones. We do have a donation jar for those who prefer to let it ring and then give $5 to the jar. As with any legislative proceeding, all of our work is done on mic and is broadcast on the internet at legislature.maine.gov. We're going to have the committee introduce themselves, starting to my left, all the way down.
Good afternoon. I'm Jeff Hanley. I represent District 87, which is Pittston, Alna, Wiscasset, and Randolph.
Good afternoon. My name is Jennifer DeChant, and I have the privilege of representing the City of Bath.
My name is Seth Berry. I represent Bowdoin, Bowdenham, Richmond, and beautiful Swan Island.
Senator Dave Woodsum, York County, District 33.
Representative Dean Rikerson, District 1, Kittery.
Beth O'Connor, House District 5, North Berwick and Berwick.
Heather Sanborn, House District 43, representing Portland's North Deering neighborhood and part of Falmouth. And I apologize for having to go to another committee meeting at the moment, but I've heard Professor Dogger's presentation before and at lunch, and I'm sure you'll enjoy. Thanks.
Thank you for helping us with a quorum. We do have many committee members who are on multiple committees and so are unable to be here at this time, but we trust that some of them will be joining us later. As always, I want to introduce our staff. Behind us and to my right, Deirdre Schneider, our committee analyst, and behind us and to my left, Abin McGuire, our committee clerk. They're the folks that do the real work around here. I think that's it. We have Jake Ward and Dr. Habib Dogger with us from the University of Maine. We're looking forward to an update on the work that previous legislatures helped to move forward, and we're excited to learn more about it. I think some of us were at the MDF tour of your facility not too long ago, so this will be a review for some of us and new information for others. Thank you very much for coming, both of you, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Representative Berry, Senator Woodsum, distinguished members of the committee. It's a great pleasure to be here today and give you an update on the offshore wind program. This has been almost a decade-long effort and of a lot of hard work by hundreds of people here in Maine to get to this point. And the project is called New England Aquaventus 1. What we're looking at is building floating wind turbines that can be placed over the horizon beyond the Gulf of Maine, beyond sites, so 20-plus miles offshore. That could bring energy back to Maine, help reduce costs of energy in the state of Maine in the long run, as well as create jobs along the way. We wouldn't be here without all the hard work that the legislature had started here back in 2008 and until now. So today is a good time to kind of give you an update. Before I get started, I work at the University of Maine. This is the Advanced Structures and Composites Center, which we started in 1996 by the National Science Foundation. It's grown from being an open field to the largest research center at the university in the state of Maine. We have 180 faculty, staff, and students who work there in the lab. It's a 100,000 square foot facility. Since we got started, we financially sponsored over 2,000 students who've worked in this lab and now are in the real world. We have over 14 spin-off companies that came out of the lab from research and technology developed in this laboratory. The lab is a research center within the University of Maine, but over 95% of the funding for this facility comes from outside the state of Maine through research contracts. We work on materials and structures. That's the field of research and development that we do. So we use these materials in buildings and bridges, in offshore structures and so forth. These are our partners and clients from across the world. These are companies or other research centers or institutions that work with us on developing new technologies and products. Even though we're part of the University of Maine, as you see, we expose our students and staff to an international group of companies that contract with us. The center has received some of the top awards in research and development, over 40 national and international awards. One example of this award is recently through the White House. We were down at the White House being recognized as Champions for Change. in the area of transportation because of a technology we developed called the Bridge in a Backpack. This technology got spun off the lab. It's now a business called Advanced Infrastructure Technologies. They've licensed our technology, and they've been building bridges using this. These arches, this is a bridge they built in the Belfast area. These arches are 55 feet long. You're looking from under the bridge out into a waterfall, but the bridge is above you here. But these black arches you see come in a bag. You can put an arch like that in a hockey bag. You can inflate it, bend it to shape, infuse it with the resin. And within 3 hours, these tubes are twice the strength of steel. And you can fill them full of concrete on site. We've been able to build bridges in less than 2 weeks from the time you shut a bridge down to open a bridge to traffic. And just last, about 2 weeks ago, the company we spun off the lab, AIT, signed a marketing agreement with one of the largest construction companies in the world called Terra Armée, which has 22,000 employees in over 100 countries. So this is an opportunity for this technology to be sold, built in Maine, and sold across the world. That's an example of technologies that graduate from our lab and become a business, part of a business. This is the longest composite materials bridge in the world. It was designed by our team, the Maine DOT, and a private company. The bridge is 540 feet long. The gray girders you see supporting the bridge, they're not steel, they're composites. They were made here in Maine by a company that's also a spinoff of our laboratory. The girders are about 70 feet long each to make the 540-foot-long bridge, and they weigh one-sixth the weight of a steel girder. And they're corrosion-resistant. They're designed for 100-year life in that environment. That's examples of technologies developed in this laboratory, in our laboratory, and now has spun off the lab. This is another technology we worked on with Hodgson Yachts in Booth Bay Harbor. This is a U.S. Navy SEALs vessel. It's an 83-foot-long high-speed interceptor that goes over 50 knots. The problem with it is currently made out of aluminum. And think about you going 50 knots in an aluminum boat, and you have 4 or 5 foot seas. The wave slamming loads on the hull were causing the seals to have shattered molars and damaged bones in the back and in the legs. So we redesigned the hull out of a shock-absorbing composite, a sandwich structure with carbon fiber that essentially absorbs the wave impacts in the hull and transmits less of it to the occupants of the boat. This boat was built in Maine by Hodgson Defense Composites, a spin-off of Hodgson Yachts, and delivered on time and on budget to the Navy. The largest all-carbon composite hull ever built by the Navy was designed in Maine by UMaine and in a private company in Maine. That's an example of how we partner with companies to create opportunities in the state. But today I'm here to talk, give you an update about our offshore wind project. I'll start with the cost of energy for a Maine family. We started this program when energy costs were $4 a gallon, if you remember those days, for heating oil and gasoline. At the time, and we all know that even though we're not at $4 a gallon today, I don't see who would raise their hand and say we're not going to get there again. So the question is how do we prevent, if you wish, a sharp increase in the future of energy costs to Maine's population? That's why we embarked on this program. If you look at the cost of energy to a Maine family back at $4 a gallon, and this was a study done by two of our MBA students. The average family in Maine pays roughly about $1,000 in electricity. I rounded these numbers off to remember them easily, but they're about $1,000 for electricity. At $4 a gallon, the average family pays about $4,000 to fill the oil tank in the basement per year. And then the average family in Maine spends about $5,000 a year to fill the tank on the two cars. The average family has about two cars. We're a rural state. We travel more than if you were living in a big city, longer distances. So the average family in Maine at the time was spending $10,000 a year in energy costs. And you compare that to the average family income, which is between $40,000 and $50,000 a year in the state of Maine. That's about 20% of the family income, more than the state taxes that we pay. And that money leaves the state of Maine. Of course, today we're at $2, we're more like closer to $2 a gallon. And so that number's come down, but they're still significant. At $2 a gallon, it's about $5,500 of energy costs for the Maine family. And mind you, the important here is that electricity isn't really the big part of the Maine family costs. It's really heating oil and gasoline. So these are the two villains, if you wish, we need to go after in a strategy in the long run. If you add it all up, the amount of the fuel costs that leave the state of Maine, these are the dollars we pay away from Maine because we don't have fuel in Maine, that's about $6 billion a year at $4 a gallon. That's data from the EIA, Energy Information Administration, for 2013. Think about twice the state budget leaves the state of Maine every year in fuel costs, okay, $6 billion. The state budget, annual budget, is about three. And the other thing to remember is heating oil costs or gasoline costs go up by a buck a gallon, that number goes up by $1 billion a year. So we have very little control about that, and that's why we're trying to find a way to reduce that impact on the state in the long run. How much electricity does the state of Maine use? We use about 2.4 gigawatts. We're a summer peaking state. We use the most electricity in the summertime, 2.4 gigs. To put that in perspective, a good-sized nuclear power plant is about 1 gigawatt. That's 2.4 gigawatts. So now let's move into where can Maine reduce its reliance on fossil fuels and then try to keep some of these dollars in Maine. We looked at all kinds of things Maine can do, but the biggest untapped renewable resource in the state of Maine is offshore wind. This is a U.S. map produced by the National Renewable Energy Lab. It shows where the wind how the wind changes on the coasts. You can see the quality of the wind. The orange and the reds are the best winds. So if you travel from Florida to Maine, the wind regime gets better and better and better. By the time you get to the Gulf of Maine, we essentially have the best offshore wind resource in the United States. Some states have solar energy, some states have oil, some states have gas. We have offshore wind. How much offshore wind? Within 50 miles of the coast of Maine, we have 156 gigawatts of offshore wind capacity. When we got to these numbers here about almost nine years ago, people were doing backflips in our office. This is a huge resource. It's 156 nuclear power plants worth of wind when the wind's blowing, of course, just blowing out there. So we set ourselves to figure out how to bring this energy cost effectively back home, and trying to do it by requiring no subsidies. So how do we bring this energy back home cost-effectively with no subsidies and create jobs in the state of Maine and stabilize our energy prices in the long run? Notice 156 gigawatts is a lot more than the 2.4 gigawatts that we need to power the state of Maine. So it's a huge, huge resource. Now, throughout the U.S. is 4,000 gigawatts of offshore wind. There's a lot of offshore wind not only in Maine but throughout the country. So who leads the world in offshore wind? Actually, Europe leads the world in offshore wind. They've been building offshore wind farms since 1991. The UK, the Netherlands, Germany are some of the leaders in Europe. But Europe has shallow waters off of its coast. Typically, most of these farms are built in 50, 60, maybe 70 feet of water, and they use fixed foundations to the seabed to support these towers. Sometimes they're pilings driven into the seabed. When they do that, they have to actually use jack-up barges to go out there and erect these structures, erect the towers, erect the turbines. The turbines they're using today, the biggest one, are 8 megawatts. They have 500-foot rotor diameters, weigh 340 tons for the nacelle. So you need large cranes to put them up. So it costs a lot of money to out there and do it that way. In Maine, we don't have shallow waters. We have deep waters. If you go 3 miles off the coast of Maine, you're in over 300 feet of water. You couldn't use this because you have deep waters. The foundations would be too expensive to build. So we started working on floating wind turbine technologies. It's a wind turbine that floats in the water that's moored into the seabed with three mooring chains. And this is a design that we developed over years that now we have patents on at the University of Maine. This is a concrete hull that supports a wind turbine that floats in the water. The water level is about this high, and you have about 45 feet of above the water and another 55 feet below the water. To give you a sense of scale, on a 6-megawatt machine, that's an actual school bus. And actually, I put up people here that Jake took out. So this is the size of a human being right there relative to the size of this hull. Oops.
See?
They're drowned. We'll have to get a
safety line, no life jacket. Yeah. Where's OSHA?
It gives you a sense of scale, essentially, what we're looking at. But what's unique about this hull is that it's made with concrete. And each one of these columns are flotation columns, just like you have, if you've sailed a catamaran, which has two hulls, that's a trimaran. It has three hulls, one, two, and three. These are big, big concrete cans full of air on the inside. The concrete doesn't float, but when you put air inside of it, it floats. So these are 30 feet in diameter and about 12 stories high. So these are like three 12-story buildings that are actually holding up this unit in the water. And then the tower floats. Of course, the tower is supported by that. Now, we tested this concept in 2013 for the first time. We built a 1-to-8 scale version of this hull. We built it in our lab at the University of Maine using concrete, all built in Maine by us and Chimbro and others who had over 30 companies that participated in this project from Maine and others. And took it from Orono to Brewer on three trucks, flatbed trucks, assembled it with the tower and turbine, and you can see we had 1,600 people show up for the event. and put it in the water, right, in Brewer, and towed it out to sea. You can see how it's being towed to sea. This is a Maine Maritime Academy boat. That's a 1 to 8 scale version of that unit, so it's 1/8 the size. But it looks like the other one altogether. We towed it out to Castine and moored it to the seabed. When it arrived in Castine, we pre-installed 3 mooring lines, just like you have on a boat. And each mooring line is attached to each one of the 3 flotation columns. When it arrived also, we had an undersea cable that was connected to the CMP grid. And when it came in, we brought the cable up through the unit and connected it to the grid. It had over 60 sensors on it, so this is a big experiment. It's like a big floating laboratory. It told us how the unit moves in the water, what the waves look like around the unit, what the wind looks like around the unit. And the good news is it did exactly what our models predicted. That's why we did it. We did that experiment. And this is a unit looking at it from Castine. And the cable comes from under the water and up to the CMP grid. It was there for 1.5 years, as I said. And actually, the folks in Castine liked it so much when we wanted to take it out after the test ended, they said, hey, why do you want to take it out? Actually, we love this unit. And actually, it actually drove tourism. The schooner rides they were giving, everybody wanted to go see the floating turbines. It was pretty interesting.
Dr. Dogger, may we chime in with a question at this point, or do you want to wait till the end?
Yeah.
I see Representative O'Connor has a question.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. So did you actually, with this demonstration or future demonstrations, did you actually produce wholesale electricity?
Yes, we did.
You did. Do you know how much you produced?
Yes, it's basically, yeah, we have the data. We can provide it to you. I don't have it off the top of my head, but yes, we did. What we did is we put it on the grid, essentially. We didn't charge CMP for it, but we just put it on the grid for the test. Yeah.
With that, I'd be really interested because I'd like to do like a cost differential and see what that was and compare it to what a full-size model would be.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, absolutely. Because, we're happy to work with you on that and compare the two for you. Yeah.
That would be great. Yeah. And I'd love to get the meter readings from that. I don't know. Do you have those? Are those available?
I'll probably have to go to CMP and get them, but probably could.
Okay, that would be wonderful. Yeah. I'd love to see that.
Sure.
Thank you.
Yeah. So
if I may, just a quick follow-up on that. I think I visited the site at one point, and I assume that the wind resource is a little bit different where it was located. So
yes.
It might be somewhat apples to oranges.
Yeah, it's hard to make that comparison because this was a test to test actually how the motion of the unit moves to the water. We're not trying to make electricity. We're not trying to maximize electricity production here. Mm-hmm. We just plugged it to the grid. We would turn it off, you know, for 2 or 3 weeks at a time to test it and so on and so forth. So it wasn't really running. Yeah. It was mostly to test how it responds to the waves and the winds. This is a structural test, a marine test, not an electricity test. Plus, it's not a location I would put a wind turbine anyway. It's not a place. It's a sheltered location where you don't have a lot of good winds. So to put that in perspective, really, we can't compare the two sites. It's really apples and oranges. But happy to give you the data anyway, but I wouldn't make a comparison. Okay. So,
Thank you.
Looking at that, this is the 1 to 8 scale version. And because it's 1 to 8 scale, it saw a lot of large storms relative to its size. This is called Winter Storm Electra. And you can see here, this is a snowstorm, and this represented close to a 50-year return period events. This is 50-year relative to the size of the hull. And you can see the wind blowing across. You look at the waves crashing on the hull. And as you look at that hull with a 50-year storm going relative to the size of the hull, it's barely moving. And that's how we prove that the technology works. And the unit has 60 sensors to, and that was the purpose of the whole experiment, is to prove that the hull is not going to move with the waves and the wind and survive a 500-year storm. Do we know enough of the physics of this experiment to predict what happens in a 500-year storm? A 500-year storm in the Gulf of Maine has 70-foot waves. So the question is, how is it going to survive a 70-foot wave? That was the sole purpose of that experiment. It was not really an experiment to produce electricity. It was an experiment to find out if it can survive a 500-year storm and whether we can really predict what happens. So you could see that it did extremely well. It was an extremely successful program. As a result of that, we're moving now to build the full-size units. That's the goal of the program. We competed starting a number of years ago under a federal program called the Advanced Technology Demonstration Program for Offshore Wind. This is a program created by the Department of Energy to develop technologies that will reduce costs of offshore wind. Our number one goal is to be able to put electricity on the grid with no subsidies. Okay, that's the goal here. That matched well with that program. We applied. There was over 70 applications to start with. And over many years, the number of remaining applicants is now 2. And the two remaining applicants is the University of Maine program, as well as a project in Ohio in the Great Lakes. These are the two remaining efforts. Because of the success of our 1 to 8 scale demo program, which was actually reviewed by engineers from across the country that the DOE actually brought over, they decided they're going to invest $40 million for us to build a full-size unit. And that decision was a milestone decision for us last May. And the goal is to put two turbines off Monhegan Island in a test site that was assigned to us under legislature by the state legislature. So the two turbines are two full-size units. So these units are 6 megawatts. They're enough to produce energy for about 3,000 homes together. The rotor diameter on these units is 500 feet, 1 2/3 football field. So each blade is about 225, 250 feet long. And so this is a big hull, big units. So we're very excited that the Department of Energy selected our program out of all the programs out there to continue to fund. So the test site is 2.5 miles south of Monhegan Island, and the reason for that is the dotted line you see up here is very important. That's the state waters. If you're within 3 miles of the island, then you're in state waters. If you're outside the 3 miles from the island, outside that dotted line, you're in federal waters. Because we're in the state legislature put together a permitting process for state waters for these demonstration projects, and the federal permitting process, if we're to move the site outside the dotted line, just across the line, will delay the project by close to 5 years. Okay, it basically would kill the project. So the state permitting process was developed. We followed it very carefully, and we're planning to permit under the state process. And with that, a bit of the history of how the university got to the site. It was thanks to the legislature that passed a bill in a bipartisan fashion, almost unanimously. And I'll give it to Jake here to give you an update on where that came from. So
the foundation for a lot of this work was really outcomes from the Ocean Energy Task Force, which was in 2008, and the recommendations that came to this committee for bills that would support testing and developing energy from ocean sources, including wind and wave, tidal. LD 1465 also established the state process for test sites, and that was run by the Department of Conservation during that last 6 months, 2009. They actually looked at the whole coast of the state of Maine and looked at all of the areas that were on that three-mile line. The ideal was to get as far offshore as you could, in the deepest water you could, with the most consistent wind, so that you could have a valid test site, the sites that would optimize. So after looking at the whole state and at breaking it down into different sections, they ended up with three test sites as the final status at the end of 2009, the Monhegan test site, Damariscove test site, and Boone Island test site. And then one of the test sites was to be assigned to the university for research purposes, and the Monhegan site was assigned to University of Maine. The benefits of the Monhegan test site, as I said, it's the farthest offshore because it's 3 miles from Monhegan, but it's 12 miles off the mainland, so it gives us the deep water and the high winds that are out there. It's also because of the Monhegan Island Lobster Conservation Zone, there's limited fishing out there, so there's only 17 fishermen, so the impact on fishing is really minimized. It's also located, fishermen actually helped select that site where there was little or no lobstering at the time and no ground fish at all, so minimize the impact. And finally, there's a potential economic benefit for Monhegan Island, which had the highest energy cost in the country by some measure, 70 cents a kilowatt hour. So the part of the project is providing an economic benefit to Monhegan Island. So that's how the test site was established. And the regulations in the test site are pretty strict. The environmental permitting regulation, monitoring the number of devices you can have, the size of the cable is all restricted by the legislation. So it can really only be a test site. It can never be a fully commercial site.
Thank you, Jake. And since the legislature assigned the test site to us through, we spend millions of dollars essentially developing the test site. For example, we collected mid-ocean data, wind and wave data on the site. This is an example of wind measurements at the site. We had wind measurements on the islands. We also did a lot of environmental studies for the site. We had biologists, bird biologists, fish biologists go out there and map the entire environment to see who lives above the water, who lives under the water, to understand very well what's going on. We had a LIDAR a radar put on Monhegan Island that scanned the skies to see which birds come in and which birds don't for a long time. We actually tagged some fish to see where they live and where they go and tracked where they do it. So this is the most studied death site on the coast of Maine that I know of. And we also sent some ships out there, and then we took cores of the seabed to see what kind of conditions we have, what kind of geophysical conditions we have at the site. So all of that cost millions of dollars over the years that was invested as part of the legislation that was supported, the legislation, as well as federal funding and other industry funding. So the environmental studies we've done included, as we said, the benthos, fish, marine mammal studies, bird studies, bat studies, noise and vibration studies, magnetic field studies, geophysical studies, aesthetics, visual studies, cultural historic studies. All of that is in reports. Again, all of that was done to make sure that we understand the impact of these units on the environment around them. We're only doing two of them. We wanted to make sure we understand what impact it would have. So if we're going to build in the future larger farms, we understand what that impact is. And this is the only way to do it. You got to do an experiment and do it right. And that's why it's a test site. Yeah. In terms of the construction of this two-turbine project, the design's being done at UMaine. We're going to cast the concrete in Hamden. We're going to assemble the hull at Searsport and tow it out to Monhegan. The milestones for the projects are the following. I'll let Jake go over them.
So this is the milestones are set in accordance with the Department of Energy's Advanced Technology Demonstration Site, which would give $40 million to the construction. So over last year and this year, so we were up-selected to that program last May. So since last May, really working on the off-water stuff, mostly 100% project design, construction, operation, maintenance plan, grid integration, grid interconnection, and some of the beginning of the permitting. One of the big steps is NEPA, National Environmental Policy Act. In order to use DOE money, you have to go through the NEPA process, which looks at the environmental impact. So the first stage of that is public scoping sessions, and they'll be at the end of this month. Spring of 2017, we'll conduct any additional environmental ecological studies that are required for permitting. Spring of 18, we'll actually start constructing the hull on the Hamden site. Spring of 19, we'll be installing anchors and cables out on the Monhegan site. And then fall of 2019, the goal is to install the floating hulls. Of course, all those are subject to the milestones of passing NEPA, meeting permitting, et cetera, et cetera.
Thank you, Jake. One thing that's very unique about this technology is how we drive costs out. As I told you, in Europe, they're building fixed bottom units. Ours is floating. But we're also the first to do a concrete floating hull because we have concrete in Maine. We can get it out of Thomaston. So this is a resource that Maine has. And by making it out of concrete, also, we can increase the lifespan. We're looking at rather than a 20-year lifespan or 25-year lifespan, we're looking near a 100-year lifespan for the hulls because of concrete holds up a lot better in water when it's designed properly. And our design actually breaks up the hull into five modules. And these five modules are assembled to form the entire hull using what we call post-tension concrete or pre-stressed concrete that keeps the concrete in compression. That drives costs out significantly. Each one of these modules, if you look down in the left-hand corner, these flotation columns are made with 15-foot-tall modules, 30 feet wide, all made out of concrete, essentially big concrete cylinders. And these cylinders are precast in a mold where you can actually cast the concrete in, cure it in 24 hours, open the mold, and then start over again. And by doing so, you're creating an assembly line, if you wish, to produce these and drive the cost down. And that technology, our technology, was reviewed, as I said, by engineers hired by the Department of Energy from across the country, and they've commissioned the National Renewable Energy Lab to study the cost of electricity that would come out of our technology. And this is a report that was put out by the National Renewable Energy Lab in April 2016. And the conclusion is that when this technology goes to commercial production, we start building larger farms, we should be able to get down to 7.7 cents a kilowatt hour plugged into the grid. This is including the cable to shore and all the costs it would take to plug it into the grid. That's a major milestone. That shows that our technology will compete with just about any other offshore wind technology anywhere that exists in the world. Very exciting. The other thing that's really important is that the Department of Energy recognized that the UMaine developed technology or the Maine developed technology has a huge national impact. Why is that? If you look at the areas in dark blue off the coast of the United States, these areas are deep water, means that you can actually float wind turbines in those areas. The light blue areas near the coast are actually shallow waters where you could not float the turbines. But more, and the National Renewable Energy Lab concluded that close to 70% of the U.S. offshore wind resource can be harnessed using our floating technology. So it, not only is it important to Maine, it really has a major national impact. And that's why they decided to invest in Maine. So Maine now has the opportunity to lead the United States in a next-generation technology of floating wind turbines. And other things we've done at the site, we've spent a lot of time to measure the winds and the waves. This is a floating LIDAR that was built at the University of Maine. It's a laser, essentially, that floats over the water that measures wind speed by shooting a laser beam up to 300 feet above the water. And that's an example of the kind of effort that it took to really characterize the site. So and that's why it's so important that we take advantage of all this investment. So how are we going to build the hull? The hull is going to be built at Hughes Brothers site, which is in Brewer, Maine, or New Hampden, I should say, Maine, south of Brewer, and this is a cofferdam that we're going to build out in Brewer, in near the river, and cast the hull in the cofferdam. And to give you a sense of height, the height of this base of the hull, this height right here, is 20 feet. So we're looking at a 20-foot high, 30-foot wide, if you was base, the legs of the base are 20 feet, 20 feet high, 30 feet wide. And once we build the base, we're going to flood the, take the wall out and flood the cofferdam and float these units downriver. Now, we're not putting the tower on here and the turbine on because we can't get them under the bridge. Okay, so we're gonna take these as they are to Searsport. And right in Searsport, we're going to assemble the rest of the hull, put the tower on and the turbine on. And then so in Searsport, the whole hull will be assembled dockside, okay, including tower and turbine. At that point in time, when it's all assembled, we're going to tow it out with a tugboat to Monhegan Island. At that point, we'll have the existing mooring lines. We'll attach it to the mooring lines. We'll have the undersea cable installed. So what – yes?
Thank you. Question back on what you had said when you're putting it in final place.
Yes.
Can you speak again on what is keeping it in place? You said it's moored.
Yes.
But three lines and moored to what?
Moored to the seabed. So think about when you go out and moor a boat. You have a mooring chain, right, that looks like a parabola, and that's anchored. You can have a mooring anchor. It could be a big weight. In our case, we have a mooring anchor that we're going to install. It's called a drag anchor. It's like a little plow, like a big plow, I should say, and you drag it on the seabed, and it embeds itself into the seabed. Very well-known technology for the mooring anchor. Then we have a mooring chain that goes from that mooring anchor up to the hull. And we have three mooring chains. Each mooring chain is attached to one of the flotation columns. So there'll be a mooring chain here, another mooring chain hooked up here, another mooring chain hooked up here. Three mooring chains, they'll keep it in place. Of course.
So all of that is easier than actually having it affixed
exactly.
to the bottom with a cement pillar or whatever it was.
Exactly.
And my second question is, just for scale, the slide that showed us it getting all beaten up in 70-foot waves was not where it's going to be permanently.
Correct.
And that one that we saw in that video is what percentage of size of that?
1-to-8 scale. Oh. 1-to-8 scale. So basically we've shrunk the unit by a factor of 8 and then put it in a site off Castine, which is a more protected site. But because it's a 1-to-8 scale, relative to the size of that hull, it sees large waves relative to its size in a short time. And that's what we saw. During the 1.5-year deployment, we saw 40 storms between a 50-year return period and a 500-year return period. To put that in perspective, I would like to ask a question. How big is a 500-year wave in the Gulf of Maine? 70 feet. Okay. All right. Excellent. That's exactly right.
Yeah, Representative O'Connor, did you?
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. With all, I mean, I was just thinking with all the storms and everything, and we get some pretty good weather up
Absolutely.
Here.
Absolutely.
Did you have any problems with ice on the units, and how was that addressed? If you did have problems with the ice,
yeah, the small unit, the one that we put out off Castine Harbor, was about 4 feet over the water. So basically, on a cold day, when you get water spray, you will get some ice build up here on these units. But that's small compared to the capacity of the hull. In the big units, they're going to be about 45 feet above the water, so they're going to have less of an issue with ice forming on top of the hull. Plus, the hull is so big, compared to the amount of ice that can accumulate on top, it's really an negligible effect, so we're not worried about that.
I wasn't really thinking about the hull itself. I was thinking, I've seen the blades, you know, in other circumstances, lightning, things like that can really have a poor effect on that. I was wondering if there was any ice problems with the blades.
Yeah, we have not seen in the project we did off Castine, we have not had any icing problems on the blade themselves. The only ice we measured was on top of the base of the hull. Certainly, ice is something we're studying and very careful about in this project. If we are concerned about, we're doing ice modeling, if you wish, on the blades. And if we have a concern, we have those technologies to shed ice. You can actually heat the blades, or skins you can put on the blades to heat them to do that. But yeah, but we don't expect it to be an issue there. But certainly, if it is, we'll deal with it that way. So.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure. The other piece I want to point out is, so what next? So this is a demonstration project, right? This is a demonstration site. It's a test program. The purpose of that is to prove out the technology so then the private capital can come in and we can build commercial farms farther out beyond the horizon. There's no plan to put any commercial farms near Monhegan Island. This is just a two-turbine test site. The goal here is to be able, in the long run, to put floating farms 20 miles off the coast of Maine plus. To give you a sense, if we made a goal of, say, a gigawatt of offshore wind off the coast of Maine by 2030, if we set a goal like that, a gigawatt project is about a nuclear power plant size, right? We said a good nuclear power plant size. That would be about a $4 billion project and has the opportunity to create close to 2,000 jobs. That's an example of the kinds of opportunities that we have ahead of us. But we're not the only ones thinking that way. So the UK, for example, has a goal of 30 gigawatts by 2020 and is estimating 60,000 jobs at that time. And they're well on their way to get there. The US has a plan that was developed for 86 gigawatts by 2050, $350 billion investment, $175,000 jobs. We want to make sure Maine is at the forefront of getting these jobs. That's one reason we're doing this. If, again, we set Maine a modest 1 gigawatt by 2030, if we set a goal like that for ourselves, that's still a very significant impact on the state economy. To put that in perspective, the other piece is if we start looking 20 years down the road, 30 years down the road, there is a major push to use electric vehicles in the future. And there's an opportunity in 20 or 30 years that maybe half of us would be driving electric vehicles. And that's not, of course, nobody knows for sure, but there are some predictions that we might get there. And if these vehicles, and if you look at Japan, for example, very interesting. Right now in Japan, there is more electric vehicle charging stations than there are gasoline charging stations. So there's a lot going on. In Europe, there's a country that actually putting together a bill to ban the use of a gasoline vehicle by the mid-2020s. There's a lot going on around the world in that direction. But to put things in perspective, let us say for a brief minute, in 20 or 30 years, we might have half of our fleet to be electric vehicles. If that's the case, then each vehicle is a battery, and we can store energy in those batteries. And these vehicles can put electricity back on the grid through V2G technology, vehicle-to-grid. So when we say, where can we store wind, those vehicles can be natural free batteries for us to store the wind and put it back on the grid. So this is examples of technologies that are coming towards the future. We can heat our homes also in the future with electricity by using heat pumps, electrical heat pumps. And if you recall, gasoline and heating oil was the biggest issue with Maine families' energy costs. If we can reduce those costs using this and stabilize them using these kinds of technologies, we can have a major benefit in the future for the state of Maine. So our vision here in the 2020s, 30s, and beyond is if Maine were to construct commercial farms, floating farms beyond the horizon, that would help with home heating, that help with filling up cars of the future and with electricity bills, and sell some of it to the rest of the New England states, that could be potentially a major important component of our economy. We could be selling electrons to the Northeast marketplace. New England alone, the New England ISO grid, as you know, is about a 30-gigawatt grid. From New York to Maine, the area between New York and Maine, including Pennsylvania, is an area no bigger than the state of Texas with 55 million people who currently pay the highest electricity costs in North America. Why can't we sell them electricity? Why can't we create jobs in Maine and manufacture electrons, just like we produce potatoes and lobsters and so forth, and sell them and create jobs in our state, in addition, of course, to take care of our own needs? That's kind of a vision that we're looking at for the state. And if we did that, if we started building these offshore farms, we can remember the $6 billion that leaves the state of Maine every year we talked about? a lot of that potentially, or important parts of that in the future, could actually stay in Maine. Rather than sending our energy dollars away from Maine, we can keep our energy dollars in Maine, use those to build this infrastructure and maintain it, and the fuel is free. So moving on, where is the world? And is offshore wind costly? Well, this year, Europe stunned the world with three major projects where in July of 2016 in the Netherlands, they bid a project, and the winning bidder was able to bid a 350-megawatt project at 7.27 eurocents a kilowatt hour. A couple months later, in September of 2016, a project, this time in Denmark, again 350 megawatts, won by Vattenfall, the developer, 6 eurocents a kilowatt hour. And then December, a little over a month ago, another project, 700 megawatts, won by Shell Oil, Van Oord, Eneco, and Mitsubishi, 5.45 eurocents a kilowatt hour.
Dr. Dagger, can you remind us roughly how much the euros, how many euros to the dollar, so how this might translate?
Right now, they're pretty close. Yeah. So they're within 5% now. Yeah. So
thank you.
Yeah. So the good news here is people thought offshore wind is going to be too expensive, but the industry in Europe since 1991 has been able to scale up, to be able to reduce its costs, and now we're in a point where they're competing on the grid at these costs with really no subsidies. And that, of course, our first projects will be expensive in the U.S. We know that. But once we get the industry going, and it's, then the costs are going to drop. So we have, and today in the New York Times, coincidentally enough, there's a major story on that, on offshore wind. So this is the New York Times Business Day. It says, an opportunity arises offshore. I would recommend you read it. Or it tells about what's going on in Europe. Would you like a copy of it? Yes.
No, actually, yeah. I
yeah.
have a question.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I'm trying to jog my memory back, but I remember Statoil came here, and they wanted to develop here in Maine, and they were going to invest millions and millions of dollars of their own money. And I don't know if that's the project or not that you're talking about, but they dropped $42 million just now in New York. But they also, in January of this year, they have all this floating technology, and they have a project that they're putting in Scotland that is $2 billion. And didn't we kind of drop the ball by not allowing them to make their private investments here?
Actually, you know, none of these projects are Statoil's projects, the one I'm showing on the screen anyway, but certainly Statoil is a big player nationally and internationally. Mm-hmm. They're building actually a project in Scotland right now, 5-6 megawatt units, 30 megawatt in Scotland. Mm-hmm. And they're looking at New York because I'll tell you in just a minute why. But certainly Maine has a huge opportunity still to be a leader in floating offshore wind. This technology is being recognized as a leader in the U.S., so we still have a huge opportunity for Maine to continue to lead, but we can't blink now.
I think we already blinked, but thank you.
So in terms of what's going on with floating offshore wind, there's a huge international competition going on right now, huge. Statoil is just is one of the many, and I think that's really important. To give you a sense, and that's really important, as we said, Maine is the only state in the U.S. who's going to build the first floating farm, right? It's going to build the first floating farm. We're the only project right now with a project that's going to have the first, hopefully, to get in the water in 2019. So Maine is still leading. But I want to tell you, just last year, France funded three demonstration projects for floating wind, three, not one, using three different technologies. Little France, big U.S. Little France has three projects. Big U.S. has one only in Maine right now. So we've got some challenge going on. Portugal is about to put a 25-megawatt floating project. Scotland, the Statoil project that you just referred to, Representative O'Connor, that's a 30-megawatt project of Scotland. Japan has already deployed two demo hulls, is about to do another one, did a study where there's a 500-gigawatt potential of Japan's coast, and they're planning to replace nuclear power there with floating offshore wind. Germany is investing $1 billion a year in research and development for offshore wind, including floating. So we have a major international competition. There's a variety of studies done that have shown that the floating offshore wind technology could be the technology of the future, with the potential growth from a quarter of a trillion to $500 billion globally in the next two decades. Okay, so the important thing is, because of what the legislature has done back in 2008, because of a decade of work that we've done in research and development, Maine is still an important player. Maine is still leading the United States. And we just want to make sure we stay that way. And that's why we're here today, and we really appreciate that you've given us this opportunity. So what's going on in the rest of the United States? Nobody's sleeping. Everybody's working really hard. So the areas on the East Coast I'm showing you right here, the areas in blue, have already been leased by the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management. Off the coast of Massachusetts, two major leases were awarded, one of them to Dong Energy for a gigawatt each. Off the coast of New York, a lease sale took place here in December, and then it was leased at a gigawatt. We have other leased areas on the East Coast of the United States. Two other major developments in July of last year. The state of Massachusetts, led by Representative Haddad, put together a bill to require Massachusetts utilities to buy 1.6 gigawatts of offshore wind by 2027 to drive the industry. The bill has a huge bipartisan support, and the Governor Baker signed it into law at the end of July. So Massachusetts is about to embark on creating a whole new industry worth $5 to $6 billion by 2027. South of Massachusetts, Governor Cuomo of New York announced just this month 2.4 gigawatts goal by 2030 off the coast of New York. And you should see the developers flock into New York, including, of course, Statoil and many others. So I think there's an opportunity for Maine to kind of look at where we are today, again, maybe revisit where we stand, revisit where the rest of the United States is in the world, and really develop a plan for the future. And the first cornerstone of that plan is make sure we execute on this 2.6 megawatt off Monhegan Island. Very important. And then, I'll open it up to discussion. Thank you for your time. This is a shot of the Volturnus 1 to 8 scale we put off Gastein. This happens to be a 22.6 meter wave equivalent. That's 70 foot wave relative to the size of the hull. This happens to have occurred January 25, 2014 at 1:38 p.m. Okay, that's relative. You see the size, how big that wave is. It kind of covered the hull, but the hull is barely moving, right? That's how we've proven the technology works. So without your support, without legislature support in 2008, we wouldn't be here today. Because of your support, Maine leads floating offshore wind. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, Senator Woodson?
Thank you for a very interesting presentation. Now, what obstacles are you facing in Maine as far as legislation, PUC, or New England, or the federal government? What hurdles do you have to get over?
Certainly, policy issues are always very important because the winds are changing all the time at the policy level. But certainly, we've been very blessed in the state of Maine with really very strong bipartisan support for this project. Just last in April of last year, May of last year, when we submitted our proposal to the Department of Energy for the $40 million, we had one letter signed by our four leaders in the state, four legislative leaders, all on both sides, signing to the DOE, telling the DOE Maine will do everything we can. And this is both R's and D's to make sure this project succeeds. So I tell you, we are very blessed with this bipartisan support for this program in the state of Maine. And so hopefully we'd like to continue to work with you. And really, I think that what's important right now is we need to maybe convene even a smaller committee or smaller group that can look at where Maine can go to the next level. How do we build on what we've done so we don't get run over by the rest of the world? So, Jake, you want to add to that?
No, I think that's exactly right. I think one of our competitive advantages at DOE was the fact that we had the test site legislation, that we had state permitting, that we had the ability to not have to go through a five-year BOEM process. So certainly all the groundwork that we had at PPA, everything that we've done as a state really positioned us competitively, especially when we were trying to bring in new technology that was a little bit less conventional than what they were used to.
So I would recommend there's so much we can do to move to the future. I think we've gotten to this point through this 2008 legislature. We need to reboot that legislation right now and figure out where we can go in the future. And so Maine really continues to move forward and compete with the other states who are really moving very fast. So,
you know, it is challenging with the third of the legislature being new every 2 years to, right, you know, make sure we remember where we've been and exactly how we got there. And you know, I mean, I think the conversation around Statoil is a good reminder as well. But certainly the legislative history that you led us through is very helpful. And I know you presented to a caucus. Was there good attendance at that today?
Yes, exactly.
Yes, yep. Excellent. But it sounds almost as if you might be suggesting a task force. There was one in 2008. Is that what I hear you?
Certainly, it would be helpful to at least get together, formally or informally, to really look at the future of the state of Maine. I think if we don't do that, we're flying blind right now.
So to review the Ocean Energy Task Force, for the activities of the 2008-2009, looking at the recommendations that were then in place that led to, you know, statutes, and sort of take the pulse of what's happened, because that supported both wind and tidal, ocean wind and ocean tidal. So there's been a lot of activity in all of that, and frankly, we're in a little bit of a different energy situation than we were in 2008. And the advances in technology have been tremendous. I mean, even the advances in these turbines in the last 5-6 years, you know, when we first started talking, 3 megawatts was the norm. They're already talking 8, 10, 12 megawatts. So all the technology is advancing quite rapidly now that the industry is maturing, and it really lends itself, because certainly the opportunity to manufacture these in Maine is really the big ticket. So when we started looking at commercial sites where you could manufacture, commercial sites where you could establish an assembly line where you could make, you know, tens and hundreds of these, that's a whole new part of the economic development space that we've only begun to scratch the surface on.
And, you know, to emphasize the importance of that, Representative Haddad, who actually drafted the bill in Massachusetts, the 1.6 gigawatt bill, she really loves Maine. She told me, I'm happy to come and, you know, talk to legislators in Maine, the Energy Utilities Committee, and work with you to figure out how maybe we can do something similar in the state of Maine. It was a very, very strong bipartisan effort, overwhelmingly voted by the legislature in Massachusetts to move this whole program forward. So very willing to do that and come up and talk to you about what maybe she can come and give a presentation if you wish. And she's asked me to bring that opportunity in front of you as well. The other thing that Massachusetts has done, they've also invested to build up port facilities to allow them to actually create the jobs in Massachusetts. New Bedford, Massachusetts, I believe it was $25 or $30 million investment to actually build the fort, to set it up to create the jobs of the future in that particular energy. So I think Maine, in many ways, got a push in 2008. We need to kind of look back at where we are and give ourselves another kick in the butt, if you wish. So.
Other questions from the committee? Well, seeing none, I want to thank you, Dr. Dagher and Mr. Ward. I really appreciate the time, the presentation, the update on that work that was set in motion about 10 years ago here, and through many legislatures has been supported. So appreciate that.
Thank you.
If you could leave that in the committee room, we'd appreciate it. It's
good to have toys. We'll make you one. How about that?
Yeah, for the excellent. Committee room. Perfect. That'd be great. No, very enlightening presentation.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity to be here. Thanks for your attention.
We're going to break for about 3 minutes, no more. Please don't go far. And then we will reconvene with some presentations on biomass.
Good to see you. Yeah, good to see you. Yeah, how you been?
Good.